Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is someone who's used to asking the hard-hitting questions rather than answering them. After enjoying 18 successful years as a foreign affairs specialist at ITN, he went on to be the longest-serving anchor on BBC World News before retiring in 2014 with a significantly fuller trophy cabinet. Now he's dedicating his time to his ongoing project Think Unthink, warning global leaders of a changing social climate and the need for a new imperative for leadership in a disruptive age. Nick Gowing, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Hello.
Now, you're widely known to a global viewership for your work in television news, and you've just now produced your fourth book. It's called Thinking the Unthinkable. It's written with Chris Langdon, who's the founder director of Reconciliation Through Film. He's also the former managing director of the Oxford Research Group, and I want to talk about the book in some detail. But first, I wanted to find out a little bit about your life and the path that led you to this point. So I understand that you read geography. So why journalism?
I always wanted to do this. I read geography many, many years ago. It was a way of doing what I wanted to do at Bristol University. But in fact, when I was at Bristol University, I did a lot of journalism. That's the way people in journalism get into journalism, by showing they're determined to get up like you at 4:30 in the morning and go on air at 6 o'clock before I went to lectures and so on. And it was in my blood, and I wanted to do it when I was young. And I have to say that in those days, great ambition was to use celluloid. It's that thing called film. And my ambition was to make films and record things, and it's in the DNA.
Cutting tapes up with razor blades and things, yeah.
Yes, we could get very maudlin about this, but yes, this idea of using files and being able to edit on your MacBook, forget it. This was about quarter-inch tape, razor blades, and bits of sticky stuff to stick it together, and you couldn't use it again.
Of course, you went on to have a hugely successful career at ITN. I wonder what enticed you over to the BBC World News, which at that time was really just a fledgling station.
But I should say that, you know, it's easy to say go from one thing like geography and being at university to ending up at ITN and then at the BBC. But it's a greasy pole to climb, and it still is, and it's even tougher now, probably. So the idea that I just sort of suddenly swanned into a job, no, you've got to fight very, very hard. I was at ITN, Channel 4 News, when it had a rating of zero. That's the programme at 7 o'clock, which is the news analysis programme. And I joined it in 1983, when everyone said it has no future. And now, of course, it's probably the most successful programme on British television news journalism. And when I joined, it did have a rating of zero. And when I left 18 years later, it had a rating of about a million, which for 7 o'clock in the evening is incredibly good. And Jon Snow, of course, is the presenter. But it was about the challenge then of trying to do news analysis on the day, which we now take for granted, but it was incredibly tough. Turning around stuff, whether it be in the European Union, nasty places where there were no satellite links. I was in Afghanistan, the only journalist, along with Lise Doucette, who worked for the BBC, during 1988-89, when the Russians were leaving, and I reported that the Russians were leaving, even though they denied they were leaving. We could see the stuff happening. But getting the images out in those days on analog tapes, it was really tough. And I also won a BAFTA award in 1981 for my coverage of martial law in Poland. And we now take it for granted what's happening in Eastern Europe. But in those days, these were communist countries. They didn't like people like me. It was very difficult to get visas. I managed to get accreditation in Poland just in time. In fact, we were celebrating being given accreditation in Poland in December 1981 when martial law was declared. And in those days, it wasn't about getting your iPhone out and uploading something onto WhatsApp or onto Slack or something. This was about recording onto a large analog tape about the size of a normal book these days, then editing it, taking apart the tape, and then shipping the bobbins, in other words, one of the two rolls around which the tape was wrapped, out, strapped to people's legs. And one of them was sent to Sweden, one of them was sent to Berlin, and one of them was sent to Vienna via Prague, and only one of them got through. But it got out, and we were able to show what was going on in martial law in Poland. Of course, you might say, why did that matter? In those days, there was not the ability, there was not Twitter, there was no way of communicating. In fact, we didn't even have a telex machine that worked. Everything had to be going through the censor. And I've written a lot on that in my time as a journalist, talking about the new vulnerability of power, politics and systems from the digital community. And I think back to some of those places where I was using film and where I was using tape, where I think to myself, what would happen now? Could there be a coup? Could there be that kind of authoritarian clampdown? And therefore, what is happening in Eastern Europe at the moment with Poland, with Hungary, with Italy? It's a very, very different environment. And so much of what we tried to report, and I tried to report, and I was banged up by the secret police on many occasions, by the KGB, by the secret police in Poland and Hungary. I just see a lot of it rolling back now. And that, I think, is the rather sinister issue, which is at the heart of thinking the unthinkable as well, about things which we thought were in place are now being unravelled.
Absolutely. You go into that very deeply in your book. All of this time in the field, though, tremendously exciting as well as dangerous and very important work. Why then give it up to go and sit behind a news desk?
I didn't give it up at all. Let me roll back to when I joined the BBC in 1996, what is now known as BBC World News, which was the BBC's answer to CNN. It didn't really work properly because there wasn't funding. The BBC, because of its constraints, can't accept a lot of commercial funding. There were problems at that time. But I saw what was going on in the television and the media business as something about getting the message out internationally. The BBC had the BBC World Service radio on shortwave and increasingly on FM. And for me, it was the next challenge. And I like to be ahead of where the curve is taking things. And most people thought I was nuts, but I wanted to go to the BBC to see if it was possible to apply the kind of instant and analytical journalism which I was doing as diplomatic editor at Channel 4 News on a one-hour programme to rolling news at the same time. It was tough. It was doable, but it wasn't as easy as I thought it might be. But it wasn't about sitting behind a desk. I spent a lot of time on the road for BBC World News. Now much of it can be done off a laptop. It can be done on broadband and so on. In those days, getting satellite dishes was incredibly expensive, even in a place like India, where you had to more or less get a license for every uplink, and it cost an enormous amount of money. So the idea that I was sitting behind a desk, I was for a lot of the time, but not all of the time, because it was about taking the message out and getting the message out. The technology now means you don't think twice about it. But in those days, in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was incredibly tough still. And I saw that as a major challenge. And that's what I've always wanted to do as a journalist, you know, learning it from my time at ITN, never taking no for an answer.
Watching you from abroad, sitting in Zimbabwe, in fact, I watched you break 9/11. I watched you break the death of Princess Diana. Yeah. Both huge, huge stories. And I wonder sometimes if you're aware of the impact that you had all over the world.
Yes. I do in retrospect. I tell you, it's lonely sitting in a studio looking at a piece of glass when you have to think about people out there. One of the reasons I travelled and travel so much is to get a sense of the people that one was broadcasting to. But remember, on 9/11, I happened to be on a bus going into work when it happened. And I then ended up on the air for about 5 hours. And I had to keep saying, this is not a Hollywood movie. What you're seeing is reality. And it makes you realise the enormity of what you're doing when people tell you afterwards, I was watching you, I was watching you, I was watching you. This is not about vanity. It's actually about doing it well and doing it as a service and hopefully getting the journalism right and trying to self-correct all the time. And I think the tragedy or the problem we've got now is all as journalists, although I don't really do it anymore now, is the power of Twitter, is the power of what that terrible word that Trump has developed, or phrase, fake news. It's about verifying information. And I was always conscious, particularly when there were events happening abroad, that people were watching us and basing their decisions on what someone like me would say. And if I got it wrong, or we got it wrong, that could be terrible, including in places like Zimbabwe, where people would make their tactical judgments based on what they were watching on television. And that's a scary position to be in. Similarly with Diana, I mean, I could tell much of more of the story. It's well known now, but I literally had rolled off a plane from Japan, having had a little too much beer at a karaoke party in a diplomatic academy. We also had people in for dinner to celebrate a Greek sailing holiday. I went to bed at 12:30 and 10 past one. I got a call. In those days, mobile phones barely existed, from my editor saying, Dodi's dead and Diana may be dead. And I used an expletive and said, don't wake me up at this time of the morning. But an hour and 20 minutes later, I was on air. Then everything else happened and I made the announcement at around 6 o'clock. But that was a classic example of still the difficulties of trying to make sure that what you're saying is correct, because there were people who were trying to fake news stuff out of Paris that evening, saying we've seen Diana walk away from the car. And my colleagues and I, and it was a very thin operation that night because it was in the early hours of Sunday, were trying to work out whether this person was a fraud or whether these people were people who actually had seen Diana walk away. Remember, in those days, we had no mobile phones. Mm. If we'd had mobile phones, we'd have had terrible judgments to make about the damage in the Pont d'Almar, in that tunnel where the Mercedes hit the wall, and then a taste and decency issue of what could we show. In those days, in Paris, snappers, photographers were arrested by the police. And so for a long time, we never saw anything. That would have been a very, very difficult series of editorial judgments. And that's almost 21 years ago now. But the reason, one of the reasons I'm saying that is that there was a big volcanic eruption in Montserrat taking place at the same time in the Caribbean. And several days later, several of my, a couple of colleagues, good friends of mine from ITN actually, said, "We knew you knew when she was dead because we were watching you. In Montserrat, we could tell by the change in the tone of your voice that you knew she was dead, even though you weren't announcing it at the time," which is true. We knew for 50 minutes because we had to be absolutely sure. But that shows the impact of what we were doing. That night, I was in a studio alone with a floor manager. That was it. And two or three people up in the newsroom because it was a Sunday morning. It's an uncanny and odd experience, sitting, watching, looking at a piece of glass, and knowing that there are literally millions of people. We probably had 500 million people watching that night. I never thought about that at the time.
I mean, a huge emotional impact on you too. And not only emotional, but on your personal life. I mean, you must have to change so many things and work around the fact that you are basically constantly on call.
Yes, but that's rather like you. That's what we're in the business for. And frankly, if you're not on call or you're not called, you get pretty fed up. You've been forgotten. It's nice to be called. And if I hadn't been in, someone else would have got the call and been called in. Similarly on 9/11 and Princess Diana's death. I mean, do I look upon it with pride? Well, I look upon it with pride in the sense that I think there was an acknowledgement of the way we balanced the information coming in and the way we qualified everything. And there are object lessons for a lot of journalists now who want to get into the business. What you see on a screen, on your iPad or your iPhone, you mustn't automatically assume that it's correct. Many people will be making their judgments on what you say, and if you get it wrong, there's a very high price to pay.
Now, you've been a member of various councils and think tanks involved with global economics and leadership. When did you start taking on those roles, and did that indirectly lead to the starting of Think Unthink?
I suppose you can say that, but I think it was my journalistic experience. I mean, when you're in so many places where you've been at the front line of what is happening, often flying at a speed which is almost inhuman, because in those days you couldn't fly fast enough for to beat the satellite signal. That was an important experiential contribution, but I wanted also to understand much more about the power, the way public servants work, the way people in government work. I wanted to do more than just the journalism. I wanted to understand the context. And yes, for 6 years, I was on the Council of Chatham House, which is the Royal Institute for International Affairs, RIAA. That's based in St. James's Square. But in those days, it may sound like a distinguished thing that I was doing, but actually we were fighting for survival. I was on the council and I didn't realise what I'd let myself in for. We were actually debating which bits of furniture and paintings to sell to pay the bills. So don't assume that these things are all just wonderful, warm things you do and have a few glasses of whiskey and just talk about life. No, there were tough existential problems. Now Chatham House is flourishing. I'm on the council of the Royal United Services Institute as well. But it's about understanding how power brokers work and getting access to them. And it was another way of doing journalism, actually, because you meet people that way. And that's what journalism should be about, not what you read on the wires, but actually speaking to people who are at the heart of what's going on in the world.
And perhaps thinking a little differently, which brings us onto your project,
yes,
your
indeed.
Think Unthink project, out of which has grown this book, Thinking the Unthinkable. Tell me how the project started for you then.
I had decided, you used the word retirement right at the beginning. I didn't retire from the BBC. I just took a lifestyle decision. After 35 years on the road, I just wanted to do something different. I was still in good health, unlike some of my colleagues who, at a certain age, I was over 60 then, were, you know, really suffering things which the body doesn't like you to do. And you pay a price. And I just decided I would leave on my terms rather than on someone else's terms saying it's time for you to leave. So at the beginning of 2014, I took a private decision to leave the BBC. I didn't know quite what I was going to do, but I was aware that the world was moving in incredibly different directions at high speed. And as I was leaving, having given my notice to the BBC, Putin was operating in eastern Ukraine. He also seized Crimea as well and seized it back for Russia. other things were happening as well. And it became clear to me, and there's a much longer trail here, things like ISIS were emerging from apparently from nowhere. Ebola had apparently come from nowhere and was decimating West Africa. 11,000 people were killed. The Médecins Sans Frontières said there are going to be a large number of deaths, and the World Health Organization said, no, 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 it isn't going to happen. Other things were happening. The Saudis were trying to reduce the oil price below $30 a barrel to capture the oil market. And it became clear to me, hastened, I have to say, by Michael Ignatieff, who failed to become Prime Minister of Canada, who's a very wise voice on this kind of thing. He came to Chatham House in March and said, we're seeing a new normal, the end of normal as we know it. And I was asked by, it was 50 years after Churchill died, by the Churchill Foundation, to do something on leadership. I said, there's only one thing I'm interested in doing. I don't think leaders are coming to terms with the new reality of what's happening in the world. There are unthinkables happening. It's a breakdown of the rules-based, law-based system. And I'd like to understand whether they really understand what's happening. And from that, over a flat white coffee, emerged this. Chris Langdon joined me towards the end of 2014, and it scaled up. The book is just a moment where we had felt we had to capture the enormity of what's taking place, but the world is moving incredibly fast. We actually published this book 7 days after delivering the manuscript in the middle of May. Now, that's unheard of. That's unthinkable in the publishing business because the world is moving so fast. So we've been as disruptive as the world is being disrupted.
So all of this is based on hundreds and hundreds of hours of interviews with leaders. Who were the type of people you were talking to? And was there one particular theme that was coming out?
We didn't go in, and this is important journalistically and also in research terms. We didn't go in to meet people saying, do you agree you're scared? Do you agree you're overwhelmed? Do you agree there's a short-term problem? We asked them to open their hearts to us. And yeah, I mean, I was astonished the number of people who, once they got to hear about us, wanted to talk to us. We are talking about chairmen, chief executives. We are talking about very senior people in government. We're talking about ministers. Some of them were snatch conversations, but many of them became much more rigorous interviews as such. Some of them said, we'll give you half an hour. After 2 hours, we were still talking. And we said, tell us about what you feel about the way the world is going. After about 20 minutes or half an hour, Chris and I would hear them sort of dispense with their email pressures, and suddenly they would begin to become very human. And that's what drove us forward, realizing that this was a very, very profound challenge for people at the top. And if I can summarize it in one word, there was one very senior figure who represented many, said, look, being at the top is shit, and you have to realize that. You're not liked, you're not loved, and no one respects you, but you've got to do it. It became clear that that was in the spirit of the way things have been, as opposed to the enormity of disruption and unthinkables which are now happening. We wanted to capture anxiety, and the words that came through are fear, scared, overwhelmed, and short-termism. And latterly, in the last few months, here in 2018, the words diversity, inclusivity, a realization that the next generation have a very different attitude towards leadership. We're on a cusp here of significant change. We have been astonished how frank leaders have been. And no one, I repeat, no one has come back to us and said, you're completely wrong. Everyone has said, you're absolutely right. And what you're doing is voicing what we feel, but we can't really talk about it.
You started this project well before Brexit and Trump. As a result, though, you correctly predicted both. What was it, do you think, that made you realise that that was what was happening?
It's more of a process, Georgina, than just one moment. Yeah, we did. On the 1st of July, ironically for Chatham House in London, 1st of July 2016, we had written in a special edition for them about leadership in crisis. The first two paragraphs were about Brexit on the 23rd of June. They're being a Brexit vote, a vote for Britain to leave the European Union 23 days later. And we predicted Trump being nominated and elected. And that's because people at the highest level were not prepared to factor this into risk. There was an organization called the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants, who, not natural bedfellows for people like us, who were very interested in publishing this in 2015 and gave us a little bit of money. We're self-funded, I have to say. We don't get money from anyone. We're not given a large amount of money for this research. We're doing it because we believe it has to be done. And we came up with these conclusions. The main conclusion, summarizing, is the following. the conformity which gets you to the top in many ways now disqualifies you from understanding the enormity of disruption and change and what you have to do about it. So that was our finding. And for 4 months, SEMA did not want to publish our document. They said, you're making this up. You're exaggerating this. And we said, no, this is the evidence. And fortunately, one senior person inside, Noel Tago, an executive director, he said, what Gowing and Langdon have done is found the evidence for stuff which we don't really want to believe. Mm. And so finally, they produced an interim report with us, which we drafted. It was a long report in February 2016, saying exactly what we're saying in the book now, but to test the waters of leadership. And again, no one pushed back and said, you're wrong. Everyone was quietly saying, keep going, keep going. What you're onto is something really important, but we can't say it publicly at the moment. And so when we published this on the 1st of June 2016 and said Brexit is likely to happen and Trump is likely to be nominated and probably elected as well, it was about defining very clearly that those at the top were not prepared to think about unthinkables, unthinkables which were happening there and then. And there was the year before another important unthinkable, which we called unpalatable. And that's an important word, unpalatable. The evidence is always there. In 2015, the migration crisis happened in Europe. The United Nations High Commission for Refugees, the International Organization of Migration, had both warned for 2 years that this was coming. But the political leaders in Europe didn't want to take any notice. And look, it became an existential threat to the European Union. Look at what's happening in Germany. Merkel is just about surviving. Look at what's happening in Hungary. Look at what's happening in Poland. Look at what's now happened in Italy. And I repeat, the same thing may be about to happen in Sweden in their election in September. No one really wanted to take notice of the evidence on the table of what was coming down the track. Mm. And it was the same thing with Brexit. Now everyone talks about populism. We don't call it populism, we call it pushbackism. It's a pushback against systems which have not really delivered in the way that people expected. And I think we can say very clearly that the Brexit vote was more about people who are fed up with the system which isn't delivering for them, as opposed to anti-Europe. Anti-Europe became the kind of calling card, but many of them are just fed up with the system. And that's what you're seeing in many other countries as well. And most are not prepared to even accept that. Even in Germany, in 2017 for the election, I was there for 3 weeks before the election in September of 2017. They didn't want to believe the power of the Alternative for Deutschland. And what you're seeing now is leaders and political classes who don't want to accept that life is now very different and the unthinkables are happening. And that's what our research and therefore our book and our ongoing web platform is about. It's about providing evidence of what is now becoming very serious for leaders. And it's not to frighten them. It's to say, don't be pessimistic. Don't be fatalistic. Be realistic and find out a new way of leading. You can still be a great leader. And some of our leaders here have been chief executives for 8 or 9 years, 10 years. Indra Nooyi, who's just announced she's leaving PepsiCo. We've had a chapter already about her and a performance with purpose. She's now leaving after 12 years, a very tough 12 years. People can still stay in their jobs and take the rough and tumble, like a bank in Singapore where the chief executive has been there 9 years. He said, I'm running a bank now. It's like running a startup. So it's about encouraging people how they can thrive on change, not be literally freaked by it. Mm. Someone said to us a couple of days ago, you're being too pessimistic, aren't you? We're saying, we're not being pessimistic, we're being realistic. If you don't like it, that's your problem. But we're trying to put it in as frank, but as also encouraging terms as possible, to encourage you to think life is going to be very different now, and you've got to accept that. And if it's not different, don't blame us, but actually be relieved that it is less different than probably we're alerting you to at the moment.
Mm. Now, you mentioned your website, which is www.thinkunthink.org. Tell me how that works, because it's the book, but much more.
We've made a point. Yes, thanks for mentioning it, because, you know, a book, you've got one in front of you, I've got one in front of you, I'm holding it. It's a drop-dead moment, and it's a dangerous moment in publishing, because you've published it, it gets put out within a few days in our case, as opposed to a few months. And then the world moves on very quickly and people can say, you're out of date. So we made a point of challenging publishing and saying part of the business of publishing is going to be keeping the website up to date. That requires a lot of effort. We're employing people to do that. It's about contributing much more. It's about updating our chapters. So it's a living record of what is happening, as opposed to saying to people, go out and buy the book. And then that's where we were in May. September's different now, so it's out of date. No, this is about a process. And it is about adding new perspectives. Chris and I are working hard with new examples and updating the examples we've got. It's a full-time job, let me tell you. It's not a put your feet up position to be in, because the world is moving so fast. Mm. And so many people now want to talk to us and are responding to us via the web platform.
I wonder, finally, what it is we want from our leaders and if it's unrealistic and what it takes to be a leader in this entirely new age.
It's a really very good question. I don't think leaders should freak at this. You know, if you're under pressure from boards facing extra pressure on regulation and so on, it's tough being a chief executive. You've got to have courage. You've got to have humility. But one of the things we haven't talked about is the next generation, the next gen, the generation X, Y, Z, millennials. They don't like being referred to as millennials. But one of the very strong points in our book, and half our staff are under 30, because we want to make sure that we're reflecting their position as well. And many of them are anxious and frustrated about leadership. And that's what Indra Nooyi, the chief executive of PepsiCo, made very clear. And I heard her say this privately, and we report it, but she now says it publicly. We, as leaders, are in danger of creating angry consumers and angry citizens by not understanding them. And one of the points we make in the book very, very strongly, time and time again, is the next gen don't like what they see in leaders. And this, therefore, is becoming an existential threat in government for civil servants and also for corporate players, because the next generation don't really want to become leaders. And that's a serious problem. The idea that you're going to go into a partnership or into a big company and you'll make your way up after 20 years and get to the top. Many are saying, actually, I don't think I want to do that anymore. And that, therefore, is becoming a very serious problem, literally, and I use the word again, existential, because if companies are assuming that they're breeding the people who are going to come up, many of them, and I had this conversation with a senior figure in a very large organization literally 2 or 3 weeks ago, who said to me, many of our staff don't want to become partners anymore. They don't want the responsibility. They don't want the aggro. And this is going to mean that one of the unthinkables coming down the track is what next? How are these organizations going to survive? Who wants to become a public servant who's bullied in Britain by their secretaries of state or around the world into saying what they want to hear as opposed to what they should hear, which is, have you thought that Putin's going to invade and seize Crimea? No, that's not possible. We've got a rules-based system. No, it's about generating mavericks. It's about generating people thinking differently. And that's what the next generation can do. And many of them are amazingly sharp. And one of the people we quote here is Aniket Shah, who's got a career of a 50-year-old at the age of 30. He says the emperor has no clothes now and leadership is in deep crisis over it. That's not about being pessimistic. It's how many of these leaders, many of whom are starting their own startups, how they will develop into something which can maintain a degree of stability, both in public service, in government, in other words, and also in the corporate sector. And that's what we've tried to capture in what is a project as opposed to just a book. It's designed to excite and make people think, actually, there's a different way of doing it. And we call it the lily pad principle. There are so many anxious people out there like lily pads in a giant sea. All of them want to talk to each other. And so we hope that we're creating a community and a process so they want to talk to each other and reflect with each other.
And it's a conversation that you can join in with. Thinking the Unthinkable is published by John Catt Educational. It's by Nick Gowing and Chris Langdon. It's also accompanied by the website thinkunthink.org. Nick Gowing, many thanks. You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough, Sarah Miles and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.